morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For the past decade, numerous communities across the Northwest have defended a thin green line, stopping or delaying fossil fuel projects that would dramatically alter the fabric of this region. But the fight is far from over. This morning, we talk again with Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, about Northwest communities that are still under immediate threat from dirty energy development. Eric's recent report, Northwest Targets, Communities Threatened by Coal, Oil, and Gas, was recently published on the Sightline website, and we have a link to it on our website, the Locus Focus website. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Well, thanks for having me back, Barbara. It's good to be here again.
So we're going to be talking this morning about your article, Northwest Targets, Communities Threatened by Coal, Oil, and Gas. And my thought when I first saw it was, I thought that we were winning. And in reading your article, while I'm simultaneously reading Dark Money by Jane Mayer, I started thinking about the hard struggle that we have, particularly when there is the kind of money that the Koch brothers were able to throw around in supporting any kind of regulation to encourage the development of coal, oil, and gas. So one of the things that was a little bit unnerving was you have a list of the top 10 and listed from like the least threatened to the most threatened communities in the Northwest that are threatened by coal, oil, and gas development. And Portland is number 10. And here, this is right after Portland has just voted to be fossil fuel free by, I believe, is 2040, and to work really seriously on being a fossil free community. And a year after, or actually only 6 months after, the city council voted to prevent any future fossil fuel infrastructure from being built in the city. So why is Portland still number 10 on your list?
Yeah, good question. So what I tried to do, sort of the methodology behind it, was I tried to look at every community in the Northwest that has faced a coal, oil, or gas project since 2010, which is sort of when the big coal exports debate started in the Northwest. And so I tried to look at every single place that faced one of these, and then kind of look back at the history of what happened, and then look forward and figure out if we can, if there's anything we can say about what's likely to happen in the future. So Portland earns a place on the list because it has a couple of small oil by rail projects, one at Arc Logistics, but the big one and the one that I think makes Portland in some ways one of the most interesting places in the Northwest is this big propane by rail proposal that very nearly was permitted and built in Oregon. And what happened, as I think we've talked about on this show a couple of times, is Mayor Charlie Hales at the time was bringing this proposal forward with substantial financial backing from Pembina, which is a big Canadian gas company. They were going to deliver all this propane by rail and then export it by vessel. When the community got word of that, local residents in Portland were not thrilled about this idea, both for local safety reasons and also for larger kind of environmental and climate reasons. A bunch of stuff then happened subsequently. But at the end of the day, Portland then engaged in this, shockingly assertive, comprehensive revision of its land use rules to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future. And so you have it kind of important, this really neat sort of story arc that goes from, threatened by a fossil fuel proposal to kind of, re-engaging with land use law to chart a completely different course for that community going forward. And I think it's a really hopeful story in lots of ways. I don't think we'll see it replicated in exactly that fashion in other places, but I do think that what Portland has done is a really important kind of beacon that kind of points a path away from this stuff.
Oh, I think one of the things that I found interesting, I've talked many times with Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey with Columbia Riverkeeper, and she said actually in my radio documentary, Sacrifice Zones, that Portlanders for years have been fighting fossil fuel fights in other parts of the state. And then when the Pembina proposal was uncovered, suddenly they found themselves having to fight this proposal on their home turf. And what a powerful experience that was, and that part of the reason why Portland was so successful, I mean, besides just a quirky land use thing and this very short pipe that actually had to get an easement proved in order to, or exception proved in order for it to go through, but it was that people in Portland or the climate action community in Portland had so much practice in other parts of the state that they already had kind of an organization in place that could focus locally. But what do you think about the difference between fighting fights in other parts, being an ally to other communities in the region in these fossil fuel fights and actually having to fight it on your own home turf?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jasmine's point is really right on the money. I mean, Columbia Riverkeeper, her colleagues Brett and Dan Sears and Lauren and a bunch of other folks there have done just extraordinary work on the Columbia River and actually beyond the Columbia River, helping to defend communities from, you know, the depredations of this industry. So I think it was a really sort of startling moment, and actually in some ways it was prefaced by the Shell Arctic drilling equipment, which came first to Seattle and then to Portland. And what was interesting about both of those is there have been lots of local sort of environmental groups that are headquartered in those communities, and lots of activists who live or work in those communities, who then all of a sudden saw it coming to their backyard, and that was a huge wake up call. And I think it, I think you end up thinking about it differently. It becomes a more profound and immediate, visceral problem. When you're actually looking at your neighborhood or a neighborhood that you know well, that could end up with a huge, very risky, propane export facility, or that's going to host an incredibly destructive offshore drilling rig for some period of time. And I think what happens is you end up kind of calling this identity question. Like, in Portland, I think people were asking, well, who are we really as a community? Like, what do we stand for? How does what's in our community reflect our values? And I think it was abundantly clear pretty quickly that, the values of Portland are not let's export lots of fossil fuels to the rest of the world. The values of Portland are, no, we want a cleaner, safer future. And that should be what our community, not just talks about, but actually acts like. And So anyway, I think it was pretty neat. I'm a huge fan of all the folks at Columbia Riverkeeper. They've just done phenomenal work, and it was neat to see the fight in Portland transpire the way it did.
Well, another thing I'm thinking about is how hard it is for people in this region to wrap their brains around the idea of this region becoming a center for fossil fuel exports. And I remember heading up to talk with you several years ago, and I was working on a project about the megaloads and that were taking huge equipment to the tar sands operations in Alberta. And at that time, to me, the tar sands represented the big behemoth of, horrors of what the fossil fuel industry could do. And it felt pretty remote from here. And then I was heading up to talk with you, driving along I-5, and I saw these oil trains parked around Chehalis. And I remember coming up and you telling me about the proposed oil by rail terminal that was they wanted to build in Vancouver, Washington. And it was like a numbing feeling, like, oh no, they can't do that here. There's no way it can happen. However, it seems that we're beginning to realize that they're pretty serious. But I wonder about, do you still feel like there's a disconnect between our sense of who we are here in the Northwest and what the fossil fuel industry sense of is what they'd like us to be?
Yeah. Maybe that's where I should have started this conversation. I think that's the right perspective, because, so historically, I mean, if you look at the Pacific Northwest going back, 30 years or 50 years or 100 years, we're not a major center of the energy economy. The energy economy is centered on the Gulf Coast. It's, there's the Bay Area certainly has a big refining capacity, but the Northwest has been this real backwater. We've been largely irrelevant to the North American and global energy economy forever. And so we've had this luxury of, of sort of, because of our natural geography, we have, lots of clean hydropower. We're sort of it's an innovative region that prides itself on environmental leadership, and that's all real. And, so Puget Sound has some refineries, but it's not like it's a big, huge refining center like you might see in the Philadelphia region or something like that. So what's happened, though, because of changes in the North American energy economy, that, there's a kind of longer story there, but, basically fracking and some other stuff completely rearranged the North American energy economy, and all of a sudden you had these huge fossil fuel deposits. You had Powder River Basin coal, didn't have a domestic market. All of a sudden Bakken shale oil is coming online, no good domestic market for it, tar sands oil, Montney Basin shale gas from British Columbia. And all of a sudden, the Pacific Northwest goes from being completely irrelevant to being maybe the most important place in the continent, and arguably in the world, for this huge load of carbon throughputs. You were reporting on the megaloads, which was stuff, traffic actually going the other way. It's equipment going back to the tar sands to mine it. And we were on the coast, of course, seeing, proposal after proposal, coal, gas, oil, petrochemicals, one after the other, almost faster than we could keep count. And so all of a sudden, you know, you have this region that thinks of itself as being, you know, pretty clean and green, is looking at these absolutely titanic, just Goliath scale energy proposals that would very, very substantially change how this region operates, how it thinks, how clean it is, and I would change its identity, its politics ultimately. So that kind of identity question, I think, has been queued up over and over again in the region. And it's part of what I was trying to get at in the report, to sort of say, well, we've been really successful in fighting back a lot of these proposals. We've pretty much run the table on the coal export schemes. But it's not over. And I think it's worth us trying to figure out where the fights are likely to be the hottest in the next few years.
Well, I wanted to go back to one more community, which is kind of low on the list, and that's Astoria. That's number 9. Mm. And I'm kind of curious why Astoria is even lower than Portland. Is it because, or higher than Portland? Is that because there were so many proposed LNG projects that were all turned back? Or is there other more threats in Astoria that we don't know about?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe the thing to say as a preliminary matter is there's a lot of this rank ordering that is to a degree subjective. You know, I've worked in most of these communities. I have some sense, and I've looked at each at individual projects. So you might be able to argue with me about a rank ordering here and there, and I might even concede it. With Astoria relative to Portland, I mean, my reasoning was basically this. Portland deserves to be the sort of the lowest ranked community, that is the safest community, because it has enacted this extremely comprehensive land use approach. That said, we're basically going to zone fossil fuel export projects off the table. We're going to prevent those from happening again. And Astoria doesn't have anything like that. Now, Portland does have heavy infrastructure. It has great, access to the river in terms of port capacity. It's got heavy pipeline, freeways, all the rest of that stuff that Astoria doesn't have a lot of. But Portland has made a conscious decision in its land use planning to say, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And Astoria hasn't done something like that. So it's easier to imagine an LNG or some other project coming back there, even though the infrastructure isn't fantastic. But it could come back there because there's nothing to prevent it from. And my sense is that as we see the energy economy continue to pressure the Northwest as an export hub, we're going to see the industry trying to go to the places that haven't enacted sort of a defensive strategy of changing their land use to prevent it.
Now, one change I think that Astoria made in the fight against Oregon LNG, but I'm not sure how permanent it was, there was a ballot measure passed in Clatsop County that denied the right for any pipelines to go through federal land or parks. And I think that's just still standing, which would make it hard to put pipelines to, if it would be hard to do anything that involved pipelines.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So it would make it hard. Like most of this stuff, there's probably a legal challenge in the offing, and I'm not sure about how defensible that one is. It's probably fine, but that's a good example of communities kind of looking around, trying to figure out what tools they have, and then deploying those tools to say we're gonna. Try to change the laws to prevent this stuff from coming back in the future, so you're not fighting the same fight 3, 4, 5 times in a row. And if that were to, in fact, hold up, then you'd be looking at some much stranger proposal to actually move fossil fuels through that port.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who's the policy director for Sightline Institute, and we're talking about his recent report called Northwest Targets Communities Threatened by Oil, Coal, and Gas. And we just finished talking about two of the communities on the list that are the least endangered, which are Portland and Astoria, which have had Astoria had a 12-year battle, which, and then in itself, I think, speaks volumes. In fact, the people there just kept at it for 12 years. To me, that's the next best thing to having actual laws in place, because you see that you have a community that's really dedicated. And that there is very little support in that community for this kind of development. But I want to go now to the top of the list, which is what you refer to as the Lower Columbia River. And there are a few proposals there which I know have people really on tenterhooks. So let's talk about what's going on in Kalama, Longview, and Port Westward.
Yeah, that's it. So I called it the Lower Columbia because it's these three public ports that straddle the river. So on the Washington side, you've got Longview and Kalama, and then on the Oregon side, you've got Port Westward, which is a little public port site near the town of Clatskanie. And those three places that have seen, I think, more proposals by a long shot than any place else, and they've had interlocking proposals. So you had a coal export company that had projects proposed both on the Oregon side and at Longview, and you've got now a methanol backer that wants to that has twin projects proposed on the Oregon side at Port Westward and then also at Kalama. So I really see them as a cluster, even though I think there may be 20 river miles total between them, or something like that. So anyway, that area is really interesting to watch right now because a bunch of factors line up. Not only has it objectively seen probably the greatest number of fossil fuel export proposals of any other place, it has a couple of other things going on. One is the economy is relatively distressed in a place like Longview. It's not flourishing. It's been hit pretty hard by changes in global trade and just by sort of an urbanizing and changing economy in on the west side of the mountains in the northwest. It's got big industrial port space at a lot of these facilities that's got good infrastructure that serves it. And frankly, the political climate is not like Portland. It's not a place where the community sort of rises up en masse and says, no way, we're not going to do this. And so it's been remarkable to see how effective the opposition movement has been there. And a lot of that opposition movement is for sure full of locals and also really skilled advocates like Columbia Riverkeeper who are helping just to explain the facts, just to counterbalance the siren song of the industry. And so when I look at kind of a map of the Northwest, look at the density of proposals, the scale of the proposals, and the absence of protective land use law, I don't see how anybody could say that the Lower Columbia isn't the most endangered region right now in the Northwest.
Well, I've been up to several hearings in Longview, and I will say that one thing that is pretty mind-blowing when you get up there is to see the immensity and the density of the opposition to the coal terminal, Millennium Coal Terminal, and to Northwest Innovation Works' proposed methanol refinery. It seems that at least the vocal part of the community is almost unanimously opposed to it. There's a few people, as every hearing I go to, that talking about jobs, and I mean, they appear to be community people. Some of them, I think, are. Most of them are actually connected to some of the unions that are on board with the fossil fuel industry. And then most of them are people representing the actual companies that want to get these projects going. So how would you evaluate, like, my anecdotal assessment from being up there? What do you see that really does represent the way the climate in the Longview Kalama area, or is there something else at play?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I guess one thing that's been remarkable to me, having engaged in these issues for the last 7 or 8 years, is that we routinely get beat up in Congress and sometimes even in state legislatures by the big oil companies, for example. When it comes to grassroots organizing, when it comes to actually community engagement at the local level, our side tends to crush them. So I think your anecdotal experience is very similar to the experiences I've had in Longview and places that are similar, where the opposition movement, our opposition movement, is actually much, much bigger than the folks who will show up to try to defend or make the case for a big fossil fuel proposal. So I think that's a really positive sign. It's not the whole story because, you've still got entrenched business interests that want to build the project. Certainly some of the unions are like that, not all of them for sure. And then you've got a port commission in many of these places, a public port commission full of elected port commissioners that has adopted a pretty explicitly pro-fossil fuels attitude toward attracting new business. And, while on the one hand, I want to be super critical about that, and I frequently am in public, I do think it is important to acknowledge that, the economies in these places are struggling. They've been hit pretty hard. And so on one level, I can sort of understand why it is appealing to hear a pitch for new jobs in a community. Now, I don't think it's actually a good economic strategy. I think it actually does more harm than good. But you know, it is on some level, I think we can understand why an economically distressed community would look at something and say, "Gosh, well, 200 high-paid jobs working at a petrochemical refinery, maybe that's a good thing for our community." It's an incomplete analysis, in my view, but I don't think we should sort of wave it away.
Well, actually, one of the senses that I get that a lot of people in the Portland, Vancouver area, we're talking about Vancouver, Washington now, are very much aware of the Tesoro Savage proposed oil by rail terminal that they want to put in at the port of Vancouver. And it's gotten, I mean, every city and town government and county government in this area, from, I'm not sure about Columbia County, but at least from Multnomah County and Clark County, all the way to Hood River County, has voiced strong opposition to this proposed terminal. And the city council in Vancouver unanimously opposed it. The Port Commission is the only elected body that supports it, and there's now a contested seat for the Port Commission. That the election is going to be in November, and Don Orange, who is a very strong opponent of the terminal, is running for that seat. And I have a feeling has a pretty good chance of winning, actually. And then the Port Commission will have shifted. Instead of being 2-1 in support of the terminal, will be then 2-1 against the terminal, and the terminal will be dead. But it seems to me, from the time I've spent up in Longview and Cowlitz County, that I've heard the Cowlitz County commissioners testify in support of the refinery. Certainly heard the city council people from Longview and from Kalama testifying in support of it. So is there a difference? I mean, why do you see that the locals in Kalama and Longview, the local elected officials, are so much more in support of these fossil fuel projects than what we're seeing in Clark County and in Vancouver?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think there are at least two factors at work. One is it's just politically more conservative in a place like Longview than it is in Vancouver, Washington. And then number two, the economy is worse. I think that they're perhaps a little more desperate to attract new industries and new employment than in a place like Vancouver, which is probably more in a position of trying to manage growth and manage the economic development that's happening. And I'm sure there are other factors at work as well, but those two leap out to me right away. But you know, I think the dynamic that you illustrate with that big Tesoro Savage oil by rail project at Vancouver, Washington is super interesting. I mean, that really sort of tells the story of what's happening, because you've got this project proposed for Vancouver, Washington, and for folks who don't know, it would be the largest oil by rail unloading facility anywhere in North America, certainly one of the biggest in the world. Big project that would draw in 5-6 loaded oil trains every day. And so it's creating all this risk for other communities on the Columbia River, other communities that are along the rail lines, because those trains blow up sometimes. And so, you know, if you're any other community, you look at this and you're like, it's literally all downside. There's literally no benefit, but a ton of risk that happens from a project like that getting sited. And then in Vancouver, it's still mostly risk, but you get this tiny little number of jobs. And so that's the pro argument, is that, well, you get a small number of jobs for the site. And so, you know, maybe kind of somebody could look at that and say, well, it makes sense for Vancouver, but it definitely doesn't make sense from a regional or broader perspective, because they're just spreading this risk, all this downside harm to everybody else, with no compensation for it, basically.
Well, also, it seems like the port is so out of step, or at least the majority of the port is so much out of step with what's the sense, the pulse of the community. And I'm thinking about when I interviewed Jared Larrabee, who's a representative of Savage Company, and he was talking about why the port is such a great place for this terminal, because it's been industrialized for a really long time. Nobody lives anywhere near it. It's not anywhere close to a residential area. Then you talk to Linda Garcia, who's one of the leaders of the Fruitvale neighborhood, which is right next to the port.
Next door.
And
yep.
She says, I live a half mile from where this terminal would be built. And just juxtaposing those two comments, it just really highlights just how, I mean, either the port is really callous, or they're really ignorant, or they're really stupid. I can't figure out. But that statement, making the kind of statements that they make. Another one that I liked, it's talking with the woman who's a representative for the port, and she was talking about how they don't have a place any value judgment on the cargo that goes through the port. And a friend of mine was listening to the show, my documentary, when I was getting feedback for it, and he said, yeah, we ship slave trade, you know, it's like we have no value judgment. And I hadn't kind of thought about it to quite that level, but I think that those kinds of statements don't resonate well with the community.
Right. Right. You know, those are great examples, because I think you're absolutely right. Like, everybody puts a value on the kind of trade that we do, and there are lots of things that are either illegal or immoral that we don't want our public ports to be profiting from. So I think there is this really interesting dynamic. So in Washington, all the ports are public ports. They're designed by this old state law, and they typically have three, although not always, but usually they have three port commissioners that are elected. But they're elected like way down the ballot in off years, down there with dog catcher and librarian, and nobody has ever really paid attention to them until recently. And as a consequence, this is actually true in Vancouver, you've kind of had this good old boys or, you know, good old girls network of people who have been involved in kind of port issues or port staffing or port management for a long time, who are, frankly, in some cases, very out of step with their local communities. And we've seen this in Hoquiam, we've seen this in other places too, but Vancouver's maybe the best illustration. So the port sort of enthusiastically was like, yeah, let's build a huge oil-by-rail facility on the banks of the Columbia River. And when word of that got out, and when the community started to get any sort of understanding of what that meant, it was riotous. I mean, people, you know, became extremely acrimonious. All across the political spectrum in Vancouver. It wasn't like it was just, you know, a few kind of rabble rousing hippies. I mean, it was pretty much everybody. So much so, the city council, you know, unanimously passed a resolution opposing it, and then went back and changed the zoning in Vancouver. Unanimously again, to prevent a project like that from ever getting built in the future. Now, they couldn't go back and sort of deal with the one that was already on the table, but you know, one of the things that Vancouver has done that they actually did before Portland was to say, "Well, look, crude oil storage in large facilities done. It's not going to happen again." So that the project like that could not come back to Vancouver. Same thing happened in Hoquiam, actually. Hoquiam and Aberdeen both zoned out crude oil storage. And it was part of what was going on was that the port commissions were so out of step with where the community was. I'm sort of rambling on for a bit, but I think there's a real opportunity in that, because some of the reason the Northwest has been so threatened by fossil fuels is because the folks who kind of hold the keys to the kingdom, which is the port commissions, they're elected, and they're elected, you know, by relatively small numbers of people. They're small dollar races, and you know, communities can elect different representatives. So that's kind of cool.
And actually, if you live in Vancouver, you might want to take a look at the upcoming Port Commission race and get involved if you feel that's up your alley. But it certainly seems like the people that have been opposing the terminal are really getting behind the race now and seeing what the power of having elected Eric LaPlante, who was the first anti-terminal, anti-fossil fuel port commissioner probably ever elected in Vancouver. So I think they see that as like kind of opening a floodgate of change. I'm wondering if you see that this is possible in Longview and Kalama, that maybe this could start to shift the political tenor as well there, I'm thinking about in Astoria, where the fight against LNG totally transformed the county commission of Clatsop County.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm not as familiar with the local political scene in Kalama and Longview as I am in some other places, but my sense is that as a general matter, yes. I mean, one of the things that's been interesting about the fossil fuel debate, the Astoria LNG question is a great example of that, is they become cultural civic identity questions. Like this is happening in Tacoma right now, on the backs of a very contentious methanol project there. Is people are all of a sudden saying, well, we don't have the luxury of not deciding who we are. We have to decide who we are as a community. And politicians lose their jobs over that kind of stuff, or they figure out where their constituents are and change their positions pretty rapidly. Mayor Hales was a little bit like that in Portland in some ways. I'll take it. I think that if, you know, I'll phrase it as a conditional, I guess, if the community in Longview can continue to show up and make clear that a big petrochemical or big coal export proposal is not consistent with their plans for the future, with their values, then I think, yeah, I think that stuff's going to trickle up to the city council, to the port commission, and so forth. You know, it is, there's good evidence of it happening in all kinds of places. I do think Eric LeBrant's race in Vancouver was super interesting to watch. I mean, he actually has a background in the oil industry, and he's been a tremendously powerful opponent of that project. And I think Eric and presumably others in the future will be really helpful in crafting a new identity for Vancouver, Washington, something that looks much more economically sustainable and environmentally respectful. So that's, anyway, that's kind of my half of an answer, half of a dodge question for Longview.
Well, actually, I'm thinking about the person who's running now for the port, Don Orange, and I think he owns an automotive garage, so he's also connected to the oil industry in a way.
Right.
So I mean,
I think in some ways those are very strong candidates, because it's perfectly okay to acknowledge, like, look, we inhabit now an economy and a world that frankly does use fossil fuels, and that's real, and you can acknowledge that and respect it, and also say, look, we need to do something different in the future. And I think that can be a really powerful message, and I think it's something that everybody gets on some level.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, frequent contributor here to Locus Focus. He's the policy director of Sightline Institute in Seattle, and we're talking about his latest report, Northwest Targets: Communities Threatened by Coal, Oil, and Gas, which is on the Sightline website, and you can go to sightline.org and see that and a lot of other reports that Eric and other people at Sightline have done about many issues relating to sustainability and controlling growth and a lot of stuff about the fossil fuel fight here in the Northwest. Well, you mentioned briefly Tacoma, and I wanted to spend some more time. Actually, I'd like to spend the rest of the show probably talking about Tacoma and Coos Bay, which Tacoma, I was surprised to see that you had that be number two on the list.
Yeah.
And I thought that this is how much I know. I live here in Portland, my little bubble. I thought when Tacoma defeated the predecessor of the methanol refinery that's now being fought in Kalama, that everything was great in Tacoma, but obviously that's not the case.
That is not the case. If I had to pick, there are so many communities that are interesting, but Tacoma is fascinating to me on a bunch of levels. So for listeners who may not know, there's a big Chinese government-backed company called Northwest Innovation Works that is proposing to build two huge methanol refineries on the Columbia River, one at Kalama, which is very close to being fully permitted, and one on the Oregon side. Prior to that, they had a project in Tacoma that was as big as both of those combined. So this would be easily one of the biggest petrochemical sites anywhere on Earth. Massive, and it was proposed right for the center of what they call the Tide Flats, which is the industrial port area, quite near the Puyallup tribe, quite near residents, quite near the federal immigration detention facility, and the community just went berserk. I mean, it was as rancorous and contentious as any political fight I've seen anywhere. As a consequence of a pretty bruising 6 to 8 months about that project, the company actually withdrew the project and said, we don't think we can get it built here. It's not going to happen. And I think their analysis was right. It had become a political litmus test. It was too hot for anyone to not oppose, frankly, in leadership there. So that was kind of the big story that happened in 2017 when they withdrew, or 2016 when they withdrew, but it's not the end of the story. So there are a couple of facilities in Tacoma that receive oil trains now. They appear to be trying to modify themselves to really take advantage of changes, particularly if we get a lot more tar sands into the Northwest. We know they're looking for expansions in at least a couple of minor ways. There's also a small, not so small, but liquefied natural gas facility proposed for Tacoma. So that's what's on the table now. But the reason I think it's important going forward is because, unlike so many other places that have the heavy infrastructure, you know, Port Tacoma has great pipeline access, great freeway access, great rail access, great deep water port. It's got a big, swath of industrial port land, and it doesn't now have laws on the books that prevents that from happening. So as you rule out Portland, as you rule out Vancouver, Washington, Hoquiam, Aberdeen, as you rule out Whatcom County, then Portland starts to, or sorry, Tacoma starts to look really, really attractive to new development like that. So as a consequence of this concern, that now we're starting to see movement in that community that may actually do something that's a little bit like what Portland has done to prevent it from happening, because they're correctly very concerned that they are going to be right in the bullseye going forward.
Well, two things I think about Tacoma. One was the train that derailed in Mosier last year was heading to Tacoma. So,
yep.
And actually at the first anniversary of the derailment commemoration in Mosier last month, the city council person from Tacoma was there to speak, who gave a very powerful speech. Actually, we aired this last week on the show. The other thing about Tacoma is I recall Tacoma back when I first moved to Oregon as being one of those places you held your nose as you drove through on your way to Seattle.
Yeah.
And it was another, I mean, it kind of reminded me of Richmond, California. It was one of these pass-through communities for those of us who thought we lived in the hip parts of the Northwest and who would spend time in Tacoma. And then I did get to spend some time in Tacoma a lot in the 80s and realized, you know, the beauty of the city. I mean, it was at that time, the Sarco plant, I think, was just starting to come down.
Mm-hmm.
And the paper, there's also a paper mill that I think is no longer there. Is that true?
There's one. There's still one big one operating.
Yeah, so there, but
the, other one.
The aroma of Tacoma certainly has diminished quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that like Vancouver, Washington, only maybe even more dramatically, because Vancouver, Washington has never been quite as tarnished by industrialization as Tacoma has been, there's a real effort to really remake the city. And I wonder if you can talk about the kind of pressures or strains between the old Tacoma of just being a major industrial center and what the new Tacoma could be.
Yeah, I'm about to sound like a travel booster in a second here, but I love Tacoma. I think I grew up here, and I grew up in Seattle, and I, you know, we sort of looked down our noses at it, but it is a physically beautiful city. It's in a gorgeous setting. It's the downtown has changed dramatically. There's a branch of the University of Washington campus there that's downtown, and it stuff is flourishing there. So it's a really neat place. Locals there are keenly aware of the legacy of pollution that's been in that city for a long, long time. They are proud of the maritime and industrial heritage. They are proud of being a working-class city that supports a real middle class. And also, they have been directly impacted in really nasty ways by the pollution. So that's a legacy of the past. So, you know, when this company proposed a petrochemical refinery of that scale, I mean, you know, people would show up angry and say, look, my yard is full of lead in the soil or arsenic in the soil. I can't smell because as a child, I grew up too close to that smelter, or, there's been cancer all through my family, or people have very personal stories in the way that, that only people who grew up in the shadow of big industrial pollution like that have, and it's pretty compelling. And, you know, frankly, there were a lot of people there who, when confronted with this kind of proposal for the future, think, the hell, you're going to build something like this where I'm raising my children, where I'm raising my family. And so it becomes, you know, a really kind of personal, visceral thing that's about, some of it's about public safety, and also it kind of blends into what that community wants to grow and develop at into the future. And so I was really, when I was spending a lot of time in Tacoma, really compelled by the people, quite honestly, because it's it has been. I mean, you know, Portland, Seattle, we tend to think that we're pretty cool, we sort of look down at other places sometimes. It's a really vibrant, interesting place that is also facing, I think, a tremendous risk going forward, because it's entirely possible that there's a sort of a return to the past in Tacoma, where it becomes more toxic and more polluted and so forth.
Well, I'd like to talk about first what the risks are, the threats, and then you sort of mentioned that there's possibly some stirring efforts to create some land use laws akin to Hoquiam or Portland that could protect Tacoma in the future. So first, let's talk about what are the actual threats that are facing Tacoma right now.
Yeah, so you've got a relatively small oil refinery there that takes oil trains. There seems to be some interest in expanding that refining capacity. and or using the refinery as a what we call a transshipment site. So it would just take crude oil trains and then ship it out, ship crude across the docks without refining it. There's also a facility called Targa Sound Terminals that is basically a big fuel handler. And they are trying to, they take some number of oil trains now, and they are trying to start handling new projects or new products like condensate, which is used to blend with tar sands to make it flow, natural gasoline, and all kinds of weird derivatives of basically that come from fracking oil and gas. So it looks like Targa is really trying to become a player in this changing oil economy where they're going to probably help accelerate tar sands development. Interestingly, Tacoma also gets barges down from Canada. People who are involved in this already know this too well, but there's a huge pipeline or fairly large pipeline through British Columbia called the Trans Mountain Pipeline that delivers tar sands to the coast now, and they actually barge some of that all the way through the Sound down to Tacoma to refine it. That pipeline is it may very well be tripled in size soon. It's by far the biggest environmental fight in British Columbia right now. And if so, this Tacoma refinery has already been up in Canada lobbying for its expansion because it wants to barge more oil south down to the Sound. So just as a quick aside, I mean, that actually is a perfect example of putting a whole bunch of other communities at risk. Tar sands oil is extremely hard to clean up. It's extremely damaging when it spills. And so barging this stuff from basically a suburb of Vancouver, British Columbia, down to Tacoma puts at risk like the kind of the heartland, the most populated areas of the Sound.
Actually, I want to interject too. Also, it's going to have to go through the San Juan Islands and go through some really, really sensitive environmental areas and that are not easy to send barges through.
No, absolutely not. I mean, strong ocean currents and tides all through there and very changeable conditions, big winter storms as well. And it's, you know, it's ecologically just so important to this region. So lots of reasons to be concerned about that. And then Puget Sound Energy, which is a gas utility in Western Washington, wants to build a liquefied natural gas facility in Tacoma as well. Those are kind of the big projects that are on the table right at the moment. But like I said, I think there'll be more coming. And I would particularly look to what we sometimes call light hydrocarbons, but basically derivatives of fracking. Propane by rail, I think, is quite likely to show up there at some point in the future.
It sounds like things we couldn't have imagined in the days when people were fighting to shut down the Asarco smelter.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the energy economy is changing really fast, and for a while, coal export proposals were all the rage. Those are pretty much dead now. The economics have gone really south on them. But there's a lot that's still profitable, and it's fracked gas and its kind of, you know, chemical cousins and various petrochemical projects are theoretically quite profitable. And the Northwest looks, you know, from the outside, it might look pretty attractive to build that stuff.
So what do you know about what's happening in Tacoma to stave this off?
Yeah, so Councilman Ryan Mello, I think maybe you've interacted with him in the past, has... he has been one of the principal drivers to start a public conversation about what the land use should look like in the industrial port area. And that is going to be a really interesting and, I suspect, heated conversation. There appear to be sort of two tracks at work right now. On the first and quickest track would be having the Planning Commission put in place a temporary moratorium on new unrefined fossil fuel development. So in that scenario, the Planning Commission would say, look, we're going to kind of hit pause on this stuff. We're not going to permit any new projects that are going to export or ship coal, oil, and gas. And hopefully that will take the temperature down a little bit and allow people to engage in a more sort of long-term planning process. Then the longer-term planning process, which is the second track, is sometimes called sub-area planning, and that will probably take 2 to 4 years. And that what that does is basically look at an area of the city, in this case the port, and say, we need a big community conversation about what's going to happen here. So we don't want it to become developed with condos. We want it to stay a working waterfront. We want to ship cargo. We want to, you know, we're not going to site another prison there, for example. That was probably a huge land use planning mistake. And then also, there will be folks, myself included, who will make the argument that, well, we don't want Tacoma to become a big export hub for fossil fuels either, so let's take that stuff off the table too. So that sub-area planning process, like I said, is probably 2 to 4 years out, but in the very near term, there's a much more immediate question about whether they will put in place this temporary moratorium to prevent new stuff from cropping up while the longer-term thinking goes on.
So one last question about Tacoma. Why is Tacoma number two on your list in terms of endangered communities?
Mainly because it doesn't have in place land use laws now that protect it. So Lower Columbia River is number one because of the density of projects, and it doesn't have land use laws to protect it. And then Tacoma doesn't have those laws either. When you go on down the list, it turns out that a surprising number of these places do have protections. So the industrial part of Whatcom County it now does have in its comprehensive plan laws that prevent unrefined fossil fuel exports. They're not going to touch every single possible project, but they'll do a lot of them. That's true. And then as you go down the list, it's true in Vancouver with crude oil, Hoquiam with crude oil, and so forth. But the reason that Tacoma landed at number two is because at the moment, the gates are wide open. And that's a pretty precarious position to be in.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who's Policy Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle. And we're talking about the most targeted, most threatened communities in the Northwest in terms of being targets for fossil fuel development. Well, I want to move on to Coos Bay in the remaining part of the show. Now, Coos Bay, a few months ago, we were celebrating the demise of Jordan Cove, the proposed LNG export terminal. But things have changed. We have a new administration in the White House, and people, I guess, have been fleeing from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which had turned down twice proposals by Jordan Cove for pipeline approval. So, and it's a number six on your list, which I thought was kind of optimistic. So I wonder, what is your take on what's going on with Jordan Cove, the proposed LNG terminal, and what do you see happening on the ground in Coos County?
Yeah, you know, so I will admit that one of the perils of writing stuff down is that it goes out of date. And Coos Bay arguably could be much higher on this list because of developments actually that have happened in the last couple of weeks. Okay, so Coos Bay has had had a coal export proposal a few years back, and that project was backed by the Port Commission, but it died for good reasons. There's not a great rail infrastructure to serve coal there, and the environmental community opposed it, and so forth. The bigger contention, as you mentioned, has been what's called the Jordan Cove Liquefied Natural Gas Export Facility. So to build this facility, you have to first build a pipeline that goes across southern Oregon, reaches the coast, and then you have to build this big liquefaction facility in Coos Bay, I think on the North Spit, and then you move big vessels in and out of the harbor there. That has been, fought pretty extensively for a while now. FERC denied the permit applications for this project, which is, I think, either entirely unprecedented or maybe it happened only once before. But I think FERC had never denied an application like this, and they denied it principally because they didn't think that there was that the company could find buyers for the LNG in Asia, and so as a consequence of not having buyers, it wasn't worth the sort of damage that both to property rights from putting a pipeline across private property, and then also the risks and harms of just having a facility like that. So there was a time where people thought it was either dead or mostly dead or something like that. But the Trump administration has elevated this project to into its sights. They have said publicly that they are interested in trying to get it built. And then the company actually just announced their intent to what's called pre-file with FERC. So they're going to try and restart the process and go back through the process again and try and get it built. So I think Coos Bay is going to be really interesting again for the next couple of years while this project makes its way back into the public debate.
Now, are you up at all with what's happening at FERC? Because I do understand at least one commissioner resigned a few months ago, and I'm wondering, how many holdovers are there on FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, from the Trump days, the commission that actually denied that, because they denied that permit twice. It wasn't just the first time. They also they came back when Jordan Cove came back, they kind of were laughed out of the door at FERC. So how do you see FERC's changes, or what possibly could be changing on that commission that might change the climate in Coos County?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but the worst case scenario is that the Trump administration gets it to act together and actually appoints a bunch of really industry-friendly regulators who just run the thing through on a greased rail. That's possible. So FERC is understaffed right now. They have not filled many of the seats on the commission. There doesn't appear to be a lot of movement in that direction right now. So one of the things that we've benefited so far in the Trump era is that the administration hasn't filled its appointments. It's incoherent and inefficient, frankly. And so at some point I presume it will change and they will become more forceful and good at what they do. But so far there's a lot of bluster and blundering around. But I don't know what to expect, quite frankly. Like, there is a plausible worst-case scenario where FERC becomes rather hostile to preventing fossil fuel exports. But I think there's an equally possible scenario where they kind of stay constituted more or less like they are now. And if that stays to be the case, then I think Jordan Cove is probably not going to make any more progress than it did in the past.
So is there a plan B if FERC were to approve it? Are there still other legal steps that the community can take?
Yeah, Oregon has some ability to regulate this stuff at the state level. There's a coastal zone management, or I can't remember the exact name, but something like that, where they could prevent the building permits for this stuff because it's a sensitive coastal area, because there are particular risks, seismic risks and others, to siting a project like that on the coast. It is also possible that Coos Bay could consider something like what Astoria did with trying to figure out if there's a ballot initiative approach or some other way to prevent pipeline construction.
But one second, they actually had a ballot measure, I thought, in Coos County a couple months back in May that would have banned, it would have stopped Jordan Cove, and it was defeated 2-1, at least as far as I understand.
Well, yes, but so that ballot proposal was a whole basket of things. It would have stopped Jordan Cove, but it also it was called a community rights initiative that was doing a whole bunch of other things, including sort of vaporizing local government. It was taking a stand on corporations as people and doing a whole bunch of other things, some of which I think were probably fine ideas, but it was a referendum on a whole lot more than just Jordan Cove.
So they probably should have done one at a time rather than...
Yes. And in my view, if we had a ballot initiative that was just about Jordan Cove and had sophisticated campaign backing behind it, it very well could have passed. I don't think that's impossible at all. This was run by a pretty ragtag group of activists. Good folks, not trying to criticize them, but this wasn't like a professional ballot initiative machinery that was working on the thing. So it did, it lost 2-1. It lost pretty badly, but I don't think it's necessarily a very good indicator of the political climate there.
So in the last moment that we have here, what can you offer to the audience as far as steps to be taken to protect the 10 communities on your Northwest targets list?
Yeah, so I guess I hope I haven't sounded too dour, but because I think that the takeaway is that we don't have to wait for the Trump administration, we don't have to wait for Congress, we don't even have to wait for the state legislatures. Local communities have all the power they need to stop this stuff. I do tell the story of Portland quite often. In a slightly different world, Portland has a big propane by rail export facility in it. And in this world, Portland just took control of its own destiny and said, absolutely not. We're not going to do that. We're going to rezone in a way that matches our values. And every community can do the same thing. Every community has the power of local zoning. Every community has the power of land use planning. And with that power, we get to determine whether we are a big fossil fuel export hub, a big carbon, throughput, or whether we are the thin green line, whether we stand up and say, no, we have a different vision for our region, a different vision for our communities. And so that's what I'm hoping we see all across the Northwest, starting with Tacoma and then hopefully in a bunch of other places soon to follow.
Well, Eric, it's always good to talk to you, and we should check in and maybe at the end of the summer and kind of see how things are going. And I was also thinking another interesting thing to talk about was that the time capsule project that you started right after Trump was elected. And I'd be curious to like check in because it's been 6 months. So maybe we can compare what your friends said about what they were projecting with what's actually happening.
That sounds like a great idea. So it's 6 months from inauguration. So I think that takes us to July 20th.
Okay.
We'll be opening the capsule back up and we'll see who was right.
Okay. Well, we'll maybe we can check back in September because I'm taking off August. So we'll think about it after Labor Day. We can kind of see who's right so far.
Sounds good.
Well, thanks for joining us. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Eric DePlace, who's the policy director for Slightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, my guest is political activist George Paulisner, who is the director of civ.works, a social platform for change. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Hugh Masekela. Thanks for listening. Oh, and my engineer, of course, is good old Patsy Colberg. Yes, thanks for listening.
I wanna be there when the people start to turn it around, when they triumph over poverty. I wanna be there when the people win the battle against AIDS. I wanna lend a hand. I wanna be there for the alcoholic. I wanna be there for the drug addict. I wanna be there for the victims of violence and abuse. I wanna lend a hand. Say.